comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
And welcome to the Kevin Smith Show, ladies and gentlemen, whoever you are, wherever you are, all around this beautiful place we call Earth. Thank you for being here at the Kevin Smith Show. Talk radio like nowhere else on Earth. It's the show where you matter. And remember, if you ever were my sunshine, you still are my sunshine. Now, if you're like most of our audience, you like the topic of UFOs. In fact, you think it's important. You don't think it's fringe. You don't think it's trivial. You think it's important. And you have heard over the past couple of years all these rumors. You've read them all over the internet. You've heard people talking about all these rumors that there are gigantic spaceships that have taken up position around the Earth. But is that true? Or are these just rumors? You know, there are a lot of rumors on the internet. A whole lot of rumors on the internet. So is this true, or are these just rumors? Well, my guest tonight says these are not rumors. And furthermore, he is prepared to show you the evidence. Remember that we have a free weekly newsletter. It comes out each and every week. Now, it's called the K-Files, and in every edition of the K-Files, you get the inside scoop, what's going on here at the show. You also get audience feedback. You also get links to interesting videos that are in our genre. You also get a free download and articles, a free download of some useful, valuable software. But you also get some articles from around the internet that are within our genre and of great importance and great interest. And it's absolutely free. It costs nothing, really nothing. There are no strings attached, not even a thread attached, okay? The only thing you have to do to get the K-Files is you have to subscribe, and the subscription process is a two-step process. So what you have to do is you click where it says K-Files on my website, and you put in your email address. You're going to get a confirmation email automatically. It has a link in it that you have to click to activate that subscription. Now, you do that two-step process, you can do the whole thing in a matter of under a minute, a few seconds, and it's free. Now, you can unsubscribe anytime you want to, and you will not be spammed as a result of having subscribed to the K-Files, because we don't share that list with anybody. Our subscribers list of all the email addresses of our subscribers, we don't rent it out, loan it out. We don't give it away. We don't let someone borrow it. We use it only for one thing, and that's to send you the K-Files. And once in a while, if there's some sort of an emergency update about the show, very occasionally, but it's rare, but once in a while, we'll send you that special notice. Subscribe tonight. It doesn't cost you anything. We'll be back right after this. right. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is someone well familiar to our audience, Jose Escamilla. Familiar to you for a lot of reasons. For one reason, and the primary reason, Jose Escamilla is one of the top filmmakers in our genre. When it comes to space exploration, when it comes to taking a look at the evidence for UFOs, Jose Escamilla has really, I would say, made a name for himself in this genre as one of the top filmmakers, providing us with really great visual presentation of the things that we're all interested in. The second reason he would be familiar to you is because he is my friend and he is a guest on this show not infrequently. He's with us several times a year, and it's always a pleasure to have him with us. Jose Escamilla, welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show.
Kevin, it's a pleasure to be on your show.
Jose, the last time you were here, we talked about a film that you're making, and you're still working on it, and it's about this so-called Battle of Los Angeles. Now, yep. The reason I said so-called is because that's what we've come to name it that. We've tagged it as the Battle of Los Angeles. But, you know, really, there was only one side in that battle that was doing any fighting. The other side just sort of acted like it was a minor annoyance, if an annoyance at all.
Mm-hmm.
So it was not actually a battle, except from the point of view of the U.S. Army.
Exactly.
They did their best, though, didn't they?
Yeah, they shot at this thing for 3.5 hours, couldn't bring it down. And it's an amazing event. And you know what's great about this event is that it is the single most heavily documented UFO case, as far as I'm concerned anyway, in the history of UFOs. The reason being is because it was documented. I mean, you know, we fired at this thing, hovered over Culver City. Hundreds of thousands of people witnessed this event as it went down, from different points of views, different walks of life. And the thing just, I mean, it traveled slowly down, you know, down the coastline. It got fired at from the, you know, from the brigades there. And then also it went to Long Beach, San Pedro. It got fired at from Fort MacArthur. Went all the way to Seal Beach. And then quickly darted back, traveling right over Los Angeles and coming back to Culver City, hovering there for another half hour as they fired upon it. And finally just slowly took off over the Pacific Ocean, never to be seen again. And, you know, that was this was barely 11 weeks after we were attacked at Pearl Harbor.
Yeah. Yeah, and so people were very much on edge because of the Pearl Harbor thing. And a lot of people at the time thought that the Japanese would launch an attack probably upon our west coast, and actually they did, but not on the lower 48 west coast, but up in Alaska, and they actually occupied at least one, maybe a couple of the Aleutian Islands. But people all up and down that west coast were really nervous because they really thought that the Japanese would launch an attack on that west coast. And then all of a sudden, here's this thing in the air, and it's not ours.
And
so,
well, you know, to tell you, a couple of days before the Battle of Los Angeles happened, there was a Japanese submarine that fired upon one of our oil rigs over there near Santa Barbara. They call it the Battle of Santa Barbara, you know, in joking, but 2 days before this UFO showed up over L.A., there was a Japanese submarine right there, man. That's close.
Oh, yes, it's close.
Yeah.
And there are reports of other Japanese submarines getting up very close to that shore as well. Now, this Battle of Los Angeles, this took place in what month and year?
It was February 25th, 1942. And the event started about, I believe it was at about 2:20 in the morning. That's when radar picked up several blips, and especially this large one that came in right over the Santa Monica Mountains, right, you know, from the Pacific Ocean, over the Santa Monica Mountains, and it just flew real slowly at about 5,000, maybe 6,000 feet, flew directly over Beverly Hills. And people, well, immediately when, you know, when the thing showed up on radar, there was a blackout. You know, that's what they used to do, is they'd have a blackout of the whole area. Mm-hmm. And with the exception of some cars that were, you know, that had their headlights on and things like that, people got clear views of this thing as it flew directly above Beverly Hills. And it was about 350 to maybe 500 feet in diameter, different reports. So this was a huge object, whatever it was. Slowly went over Beverly Hills. It got to Culver City and just hovered there. It just hovered there for close to 20, maybe 35 minutes. And then it slowly started. Well, here's what the events, the way they went down. First of all, in the neighborhood where it stopped and hovered, there was a lady named Katie. And she's famous for being one of the outspoken eyewitnesses of this event. She was an air raid warden. In those days, they had neighborhood people, you know, people in each neighborhood, they had air, what were called air raid wardens, which were to help the neighbors in case we did have an attack. They'd tell seniors and other people what to do in case, you know, finding shelter and everything else. So Katie was awakened by her supervisor, and he said, "Are you seeing it? It's above your house." So she goes out to her window and looks up, and there's this huge UFO hovering there. She's mesmerized by this thing. She said it was the most incredible color of orange, yellow, reddish, and bluish white that she'd ever seen in her entire life. She said she'll never forget how incredibly beautiful this object was. She tells that the there were airplanes that first came up at it, started firing at it, and then they couldn't bring it down, so they took off, and then suddenly the searchlights hit it. And that's when all heck broke loose, man. That's when the barrage and the attack started from the battalions. And they shot at this thing close to 25, 30 minutes, constant firing, 12-pound anti-aircraft shrapnel. And it's like throwing a grenade near it, you know, but these were 12-pound anti-aircraft mm-hmm. shrapnel that bombarded it. Direct hits, they struck near it. It slowly started traveling southward, and as I mentioned earlier, it went down that path. But if you can just imagine waking up to us firing at something, just the concussion of the bombs. I mean, it was just, people were just scared to death. Like you said, they thought the Japanese were attacking us, and that's exactly what everybody thought. They thought they saw airplanes up there. It could have been ours, but then there were also reports of flying discs that were coming in from different areas. So there was UFO activity going on that night. We don't know if they were our airplanes that people were witnessing, calling them mystery planes, or whether they were UFOs, but a lot of the stuff happened that night. It was incredible.
You know, you said, and I agree with you, I concur with your conclusion, that this is one of the most important and best documented UFO events in U.S. history. Because you have, of course, witnesses who saw what happened and who told what they saw. This event is caught on film, and you have the film of the actual firing on this thing. There are photos of it. Newspaper reports all over the place about it. Military statements from top military brass, where you've got the one in command out there on the West Coast saying, you know what? We don't know what it was. We shot at it, and but we couldn't bring it down. You have the Secretary of the Army, I believe it was, a couple of days later making the statement that, oh, it was a case of jittery nerves. They thought they saw some planes, and somebody started shooting, then everybody started shooting. It was just jittery nerves. Then you have the guy back out there where the action was, and in command of that, saying, no, that's not the case. We saw it. It was real, and we fired at it. So you have the military sort of in open confrontation with itself there. And then you have the fact that it showed up on radar. So it's very well documented.
Absolutely. And you know, the Navy, this was the first time that the weather balloon excuse was used. They actually said it was just nothing but a weather balloon. And it really, you know, if they can't bring down a weather balloon with all this armament that we have, it made the Army look totally inept. If they can't bring down a weather balloon, which it wouldn't have lasted in the sky 2 seconds, I mean, you know, aircraft shrapnel like that, but if they can't bring down a weather balloon, what are they going to do against a real enemy target? And this was a controversy that began that same morning, February 25th, with all the newspaper reporters that were on the scenes. I mean, they went to all the neighborhoods where the shrapnel rained down. I mean, the Army did more damage to the neighborhood down below than to the craft itself. But you had news reporters from all over the world that swarmed these neighborhoods where the event went down, interviewing people, you know, person after person, policemen, just every person that saw and witnessed this thing. You know, there were hundreds of thousands. So, and then, you know, here they had the press conference, and the Pentagon official statement was basically an official denial. They said it was nothing but warners, like you said. They were shooting at nothing, which was, you know, kind of dumb. And then they said, well, it was an errant spy airplane that kind of flew in the area, and, you know, that's all it was. Well, if it was an airplane and they couldn't bring it down, I mean, what's up with that? You know, so...
Well, you also have the problem...
It's heavily documented, and that's what I love about making this movie, is that everything is backed up by full documentation by the historians of that era.
Well, you also have the idea that it's an airplane. You have the problem that this thing hovered for half an hour above, I believe you said, Culver City?
Yes, exactly.
We didn't have any airplanes that could hover at that point. And, you know, and it flew very, very slowly. We didn't have any airplanes that could stay aloft flying that slowly.
Especially that were round and oval shaped.
Yeah. And if it was a weather balloon, this is another thing. Those anti-aircraft, 12-pound anti-aircraft shells do not stay intact. They explode once they reach altitude.
Right.
They frag. And when they frag, it's like a shotgun. You have pieces of shrapnel flying in every direction. And if this had been a weather balloon, those anti-aircraft shells fragging like they were, all around it, and you can see that in the film. You can see they're right on it.
Yeah.
It would have shredded the weather balloon.
It would have ripped it to shreds, exactly. You know, it wouldn't have lasted. And other reports that it was a barrage balloon, which is like a blimp, that even that, a blimp would have been brought down easily.
Yeah.
You know?
All right, now...
It's an amazing event.
You are making this movie. There's a couple of Battle of Los Angeles genre movies already out there. Yours is different.
Mine is a real story. I don't know if, and probably a lot of your listeners have seen Battle of Los Angeles, and then also this movie made by Asylum that came out on Sci-Fi Channel on the 15th of March called Battle of Los Angeles, but they're both basically military propaganda-driven type movies. I mean, Battle: Los Angeles, the big blockbuster, that was basically a propaganda film to get people to join the Marines. They could have shot at Iraqis or Iranians or anybody, you know. They could have picked any kind of enemy. It would have still been the same thing. It was just an Army recruitment film or Marine recruitment film. They just happened to use aliens. And I'm glad they made those movies because I'm making the real story. Just to keep the record straight, I decided to do this when I found out they were doing Battle Los Angeles because, and I'm glad I'm doing this film because people that saw Battle Los Angeles are still unaware that this event ever took place because they didn't even put the picture in the film. They didn't even reference the 1942 event. So this is the real deal. I'm doing the real film.
Are you using the actual footage from back then? Are you going to use that in your film?
I'm debating on that. I'll probably use it. Yeah, the setup to this film is basically, I mean, I'm going to use real actors. I mean, I'm not going to, I'll probably have some of the real people that are still living being interviewed, but the premise of this movie, I'm not without giving anything away. It just starts off with the bang. It starts off with the actual event as it went down. And I got to tell you, Kevin, I've been learning Adobe After Effects, which is a special visual effects making software, taking tutorials, staying up all night, and creating all these scenes for the movie. And these are going to be exciting sequences as never before portrayed. And I'm using actual eyewitness accounts from different points of views around the city. So this is going to be a heck of an opening. I mean, it's going to take you right to the nitty-gritty, man. It's going to start off with a bang, so to speak. But I'm really excited about this, making this film, and I'm fortunate that I'm allowed to make it. I mean, you know, I decided to do this film.
Well,
it's going to be exciting.
Now, this film is going to be ready for viewing when?
I'm looking at, okay, right now there are a few things in the works. Possible deals with a major distribution company and a major network, which I can't mention at this point. But possibilities, if that occur, and I get the funding that's required to make this film really, really dynamic, I'll probably release it by the end of the year. Or, providing I finish it this year, I may just wait till the 70-year anniversary next February 25th for the release. But we'll see how that goes. I know one doggone thing, Kevin, is I'm going to plan to have a movie premiere for the Battle of Los Angeles. It deserves that, man. This is American history, Los Angeles history, and it deserves to be seen and known about. The reason it was swept under the rug was because of World War II. This event was just as huge as that because something came over an American city, not Honolulu, Hawaii, or anything like that. This was the West Coast, man. This was California. An object came into our airspace without our permission. We fired upon it for 3.5 hours. It was a huge story, a major event that went down, just as big as Pearl Harbor, some feel. So, or since Pearl Harbor, big, you know. But it was forgotten, and it was buried for 60 years, man, until someone came out with the Marshall Memorandum that was sent to President Roosevelt. That described this event, and then here we are, finally doing a movie about it, and it's time. And I'm going to make sure that this film is perfect. It's got to be, you know, to present this event, it's got to be the real deal. So I'm really working hard to get it done right.
As a matter of fact, when I called you and talked with you this afternoon, you were up to your eyes in working on the film. When I called you, I interrupted you. When I called you, so I know you're staying busy with it. Now, we have a break coming up here in a couple of seconds. When we come back, I want to get into something else and see if there's a tie-in with it. We'll be back, folks, right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is Jose Escamilla, one of the top filmmakers in our genre. And we've been talking about this new film you're doing, The Battle of Los Angeles. And you've been working on this for quite some time. So we're getting pretty antsy, pretty anxious for you to get this out where we can see it. But I know...
You don't know. I'm chomping at the bit myself. It's just... It's got to be done right, and, you know, there are a few things that I have to gather up. I have to get some funding so I can go out and shoot a lot of the scenery that has not yet and the interviews that need to be done. So there's a lot more work to do, but, boy, I'm chomping at the bit. I can't wait for people to see this. It's going to be cool.
Jose, one of your previous projects sort of comes to mind here, and that previous project is... there was a guy, I think, in England who sent you some video of some really huge spacecraft that are out there in space positioned around the Earth.
Right.
And I'm going to let you tell his story, how he shoots that and everything, in just a second. But let me explain why I'm interested in this. I've asked several of our guests over the past 2 or 3 years, I've asked them about the small, well, they may look pretty big, you know, maybe 100 feet, 200 feet in diameter. Looks pretty big. But, it's small craft, small UFO. If you were talking about doing interstellar space travel, that would be pretty small. The most of the UFOs that people see are between 30 feet in diameter and 100 feet. So several of the guests that I've asked this have said, well, if you were coming here from way across the galaxy or way across the universe somewhere, you wouldn't travel in these smaller craft. You would have a really big starship, a mothership. But you would have some of these smaller craft on board, and when you got over here and you wanted to do a little scouting around, that's what you would send down to do your scouting around. One of the guests has said on a couple of occasions that when we talk about these extraterrestrials, they may not all be coming here from some other planet, some other world. They may not even have a planet anymore. They may be entirely contained on a gigantic spaceship, and which opens up some possibilities. So here we are in 1942. Most people think that the beginning of the modern UFO era began in 1947 when a private pilot saw a group of strange craft flying over Mount Adams in Washington.
Right.
And then shortly after that, you have the Roswell incident. And most people think that's where it began. But really, the modern UFO era really starts in 1942 with the Battle of Los Angeles. This thing, as you've described it, acted like it was just looking around.
Yeah, it was maybe doing a reconnaissance or something, for all we know. Mm-hmm. It wasn't in any hurry to get out of there, no matter how much bombardment against it.
Okay, so if it is extraterrestrial, and that's a big if, mm-hmm. I mean, there could be some other explanations for it, but if it's extraterrestrial, then that would seem to fit with what these other guests have said, that you would send you would carry the smaller craft to do your scouting, your reconnaissance, and so forth as you reach various planets. And so this one acted like that's what it was doing. Let's talk about the film that you did with the John Leonard Walson footage, and I will show a piece of that footage. I'll show your work, a piece of that work, while we talk about it. So tell us the story of John Leonard Walson and how he got these pictures, and what are they?
Okay. Back in February 2007, I was contacted via email by John Leonard Walson, and he wanted me to check out some of the footage that he'd taken shooting through a 12-inch Meade telescope. And he's a little British guy, and he sounded pretty cool, so he emailed me some stuff, some discs, and I was immediately awestruck with what he had filmed. He was filming what appeared to be gigantic starships that are orbiting Earth, either in what's called mid-space or deep space, but they're orbiting Earth in various areas of the skies, mimicking stars. That's how small they look to us from here on Earth. But when he zooms in with these things, like you're seeing in this video here, these things are huge. And He told me, his story was that he had been told by some entities how to build a device that he could attach to a real common need telescope to be able to film and see these things. And that was his story. And what I wanted to do is I made this movie Interstellar just to introduce him and his footage and, you know, the objects that he was filming, which I feel are fantastic. I wanted to bring him to the States and have him do the whole deal in front of major TV cameras, you know, set up a TV special of some kind live where he can come here and do this thing and show us what's happening, you know, and so we could look at these UFOs that are out there. Now, the thing about John is he's a real mysterious guy, very eccentric type of person, and I lost contact with him there for a while. We had a little misunderstanding, and he just put some real crazy stuff. He said that the CIA was after him and that they had confiscated all his footage and his cameras and that he got beat up, and then he wanted me to send him. He thought I was a multimillionaire. Okay, and he wanted me to send hundreds of thousands of dollars so that he could survive, and, you know, I just couldn't, you know. I just made this little movie. And we lost contact. We haven't connected ever since. But he sent me an enormous amount of footage. I mean, I have tons of these video clips that he took. Very mysterious person. He does not like to be on radio shows, refuses to do interviews. He got married with this lady that was also filming UFOs there in the UK. So he's a mystery, as mysterious as these starships that he's filming. But I'm going to do, look at this thing, man. This thing expands. Now, the amount of energy that it takes for a ship like this to expand, in space, it would take an enormous amount of energy to expand steel or whatever these things are made of. And what perplexes me is if these are ours, you know, if these are part of the Star Wars program and we made them, my question is how in the world and when did we build these things and are there people on them? You know, somebody's got to be on there to take care of those ships. And, I mean, we're barely building the International Space Station. It took, like, how many years, man, just to start building it?
Well, it's not even complete. It's not even complete yet. The Russians still have a module that they're going to send up and attach to it. And I think that will be the final addition to the space station. But, you know, it's been up there, what, 20 years?
It's taken years. And these objects that he's filmed, they've been there, and they're huge. They're massive. So, even if they're in low orbit, you know, they're huge. I did find on YouTube some footage taken by NASA of these same types of ships orbiting Earth. Okay, they were taken by the International Space Station, of all things, and some by the shuttle. And they do resemble these ships that, or these starships that Wilson filmed. So there is some corroborating evidence there from NASA itself about these objects that are out there. And if they're not ours and inhabited by humans, then the next question is, whose are they and what is driving these things? So it's a big mystery. And I want to get back into that. I'd like to get a super telescope and go out there and try to catch these things and, you know, try to reconnect with Wilson and see if we can pinpoint where these things are and get real clear pictures. But NASA's already taken photos of them. So there's definitely something out there.
I read some of the descriptions of some of these ships and where he says they were located. And, for instance, there's one that he says is in Orion. Well, it's obviously not in the Orion star system. It's not there. If it were, we couldn't see it at all. He couldn't see it. It's too far away, and even though these are massive, they'd be way too small to be seen at that distance. They are a long way from Earth, apparently, because, you need a telescope to get a good look at them. So they're a long way from the Earth. However, when he says they're in Orion, or this one was in Orion, it means that you look towards the Orion belt, the Orion star system. And somewhere out there, before you get to Orion, but in that direction, is where that thing was.
Yeah.
I've read some estimates that these things are estimated to be maybe thousands of miles long.
Yes. Very, very large. For them to be appearing in our skies, in the console, I mean, the Big Dipper, for example, you know where the handle of the Big Dipper is.
Yeah.
If you go straight below, there's a star there that is not a star. It's one of these ships. And that's how small they look to us from Earth. So, you know, with his telescope and his optical, he calls it an optical device. He gave me a little information on how he did it. I just haven't had time to dwell into it and build something. I'm busy with these films. But these things are definitely out there. Now, have you heard of the gigantic? I mean, these things are big, but there's some giant, huge spaceships that are en route coming to Earth. Have you heard about these from Pluto?
I have. And are you talking about the ones where the pictures show them as being blue?
Some of them, and I found one from the other side of Neptune that I call the large oil tanker because it looks like a one of these tankers, you know, where you put gasoline in.
Yeah.
But this thing is huge, Kevin. It's like it's as big. I mean, Pluto is just a dot compared to this object. All right. And the website is called sky-map.org. On YouTube, you can see a lot of this stuff. People are finding these. And allegedly, some of the scientists are saying that these objects are coming towards Earth and they're going to be here by December 2012. Now, one of these objects that I saw, they were saying that this thing was as big as the distance between Earth, Mars, and Jupiter. That's how big one of these objects is. And it's far.
That's
far
a little bit serious, isn't it?
That would have to be huge, you know?
Yeah. That's a little bit serious.
Makes you wonder.
What are the scientists saying about what these things are?
They don't know, but they have said, and NASA people stated that these things are headed towards Earth, and they are due to arrive by 2012. They don't know what they are. They're objects of some kind. And they're not saying UFOs. They're just saying these are just some massive structures that are headed towards Earth, and they're getting closer.
Well, if you don't know what they are, that's unidentified. If they're out there in space, they're flying. And if you can take pictures of them, that's an object. It's a UFO. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. We are talking with Jose Escamilla this evening. And everybody knows who Jose Escamilla is. He is sharing with us some absolutely remarkable information and remarkable video footage. And Jose, a couple of questions about this video footage. At the end of it, when the credits roll, when you do the credits, it's listed there that John Leonard Walson is Defense Intelligence Agency retired. Is that correct?
No, I never made that statement. No.
Well, we'll run the video again right at the end when the credits are on your video there.
Mm-hmm.
It says that under his name.
Really? I don't remember doing that. I know I put him down as cinematographer. filmmaker, but I've never mentioned that he was any kind of an agent.
Okay, we'll let it run, and when we get to the credits, we'll take note and see. Perhaps I looked at it sideways. That is what I noticed, and I think that's correct. I think that's what it says.
Wow.
All right. Now, he says that Walson told you that the way that he was able to construct this optical device is that there were some entities, some beings, that told him how to do it. Is he talking about extraterrestrials?
Yes.
So he is a contactee.
He told me that these entities came to him and didn't tell me that they abducted him. They just said that they gave him information on how to make a device that anyone could hook up to a regular telescope and be able to see things as far away as Mars, you know, just with a common telescope. And, I mean, after seeing the results of what he was filming here, and, you know, knowing that these things are, they're like little stars in the sky, and then he's getting this kind of imagery. He even had footage that he shot on the moon, of the moon, where he captured towers and things. I mean, he did real extreme close-ups of the moon from here on Earth, you know, unlike I've ever seen anywhere else, even from major telescopes. He was getting imagery. So there is something that he attaches as a device. And what I wanted to do is, like I said, bring him to the States and have him get these devices made and work something out with one of these major telescope companies and have it to where people like you and me can go out and film these things for ourselves, you know? That's the thing to do, is get this stuff out there so that everyone has access to what's happening.
Well, apparently,
and he disappeared on us, and I don't know where he's at anymore.
Apparently, these objects.
He wasn't an agent, as far as I know, and I don't recall. I know I didn't put that on the end credits because the end credits strictly said that. But
maybe I looked at it sideways. We'll see. These objects are obviously out beyond the orbits of our solar system, at least beyond Pluto. If they were any closer, people would not have to have a special device. Well, maybe if they were at Pluto, they would have to have a special device to see it, because you can't see Pluto with a regular backyard telescope.
Right. One astronomer said that these could be in what's called, not deep space, but... Gosh, I forget the term, man, but it'd be like just on the other side of the moon, you know, mid-space or mid-deep space.
Mm-hmm.
Can't recall what the terminology was, but...
Well, if they're as big as people are saying they are, and they were just on the other side of the moon, I think we could see those without an optical device. So I'm pretty sure, when I say optical device, I mean you would have to have a telescope.
Yes.
But you wouldn't have to have anything other than a telescope if it was just beyond the moon.
Even from Earth, when you see the International Space Station and other satellites travel by, they look like stars, you know.
Yeah, they're shining.
That huge.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Okay, now...
these things could be in lower orbit, or...
If so, they're not as big as they've been estimated.
Right.
Yeah, if they are, they're not nearly as big as has been estimated. But if they are as big as they've been estimated, they have to be out, I would think, beyond Uranus.
Beyond the moon, probably, because these things are huge.
They would have to be further than beyond the moon. They have to be beyond Uranus if they're that big.
Yeah.
And you've got to have a special device to see them.
The shuttle and the space station, if they were in lower orbit, right above Earth, they'd be seeing them all the time. There's about 50 of them that I counted that he filmed. I mean, he had an enormous amount of objects that he's filmed, 50 different varieties that he sent me. So
earlier this year, I did a show where I talked about, no, as a matter of fact, it was at the end of 2010. I did a show where I talked about the space-based space surveillance system. And this is something, this is not, although I'm sure it's a highly classified project, its existence is not a secret. And the U.S. Air Force has previously published their plans to build this space-based space surveillance system. And in the literature that's out there, it says that the purpose of this system is to watch deep space. It's an optical system to watch deep space for the purpose of identifying and tracking deep space forces for both offensive and defensive purposes. And I asked on the show, Jose, you might remember this, I asked on the show, okay, it's going to be looking out there into deep space for the purpose of identifying and tracking deep space forces. Deep space forces? Who's out there? So maybe what we're looking at here with these Walson videos, maybe that's what they're talking about.
Could be.
Well, let me ask.
They're definitely they're out there for some purpose, and they don't seem to be any of ours, that's for sure.
Well, the one that is on the screen right now definitely looks like some type of vehicle, some type of machine, but some of them look like almost wispy strands of energy.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you think? Are they space...
At the beginning of Interstellar, that looks like a battleship.
Yeah?
It's huge.
Are they spacecraft, or do you think some of them might be living entities?
I personally think that a few of these that he was capturing, like that egg thing there, that egg thing looked kind of maybe like it would have been alive or something, could have been an entity of some kind, but these objects here, like this one here, they look like battleships, man, that they could be carrying smaller craft. I remember there was one piece of film that he sent me that had...
Okay, now, let me interrupt and say, here come the credits. So you watch the credits, and we'll see if I read wrongly. Film by John Leonard Walson, it says. Okay. And, well, there we go. Special appearance by John Maynard. Okay, that's the Defense Intelligence Agency person retired.
And by the way, John Maynard says something. But he's the gentleman that was in there. He's the one that was saying, look, he was talking to one of his commanders, and he said, hey, well, there's all these satellites that we have, you know, searching for terrorists and things, activities that are happening here on Earth. He says, well, half of these satellites and telescopes that are out there, says they're facing out into deep space towards the moon, Jupiter, and other parts of space. And he says, what are they looking for?
All right, we have to step away for break. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. For those of you who are joining us just now in this second hour, welcome aboard. I'm delighted you're here, and my sincere sympathy to you for whatever it is that caused you to miss that first hour. We're talking with Jose Escamilla, one of the top filmmakers in our genre, and he's done some remarkable films of great interest and great importance to what we loosely term the UFO community. Now, if you missed the first hour, we started off talking about the Battle of Los Angeles. We've been now talking about this series of videos that John Leonard Walson shot and sent to Jose Escamilla, which he turned into a video presentation. I think it's called Interstellar. And if I got that wrong, we'll let Jose correct me in just a moment. And the reason that I brought that up, just to bring those of you who are joining us just now up to speed, the reason I brought those videos up from John Leonard Walson is because these are videos of massive structures, massive, massive structures. Some of them we can clearly see are some type of spaceship. And they are out there in orbit around the Earth. And he's videotaped these with a telescope and some kind of an optical device that he designed. And he, being John Leonard Walson, and Mr. Walson said to Jose that the plans for how to build this device were given him, or the instructions were given him, by some extraterrestrials that he had contact with. And it's amazing video, really amazing video. The connection, and I want to bring it up, and I don't want to discuss it yet, but I'll bring it up again, and you'll see why in a moment. The connection between this Battle of Los Angeles and these big craft, the connection is that we have had guests on this show, scientists, who have said, well, if you were coming here from way across the universe, you wouldn't come in one of these little flying saucer craft. You would most likely come in a big craft, a mothership, and then you would have on board that mothership some of these smaller craft that you would use for your scouting expeditions down to the Earth and so forth. At the Battle of Los Angeles, the actions of that UFO indicate that it was kind of just looking around. Was it deployed from one of these? And now the big question for you, Jose, the big question for you is, do you think that these big spacecraft that John Leonard Walson videotaped and that we've been showing, do you think that these spacecraft have come here recently, or do you think they may have been around back in 1942?
See, that's a tough one, since we don't have any kind of evidence that would support, you know, telescopic views of these type of objects in those, in that era. But I'll tell you something that's pretty cool. Up until the Battle of L.A. and Pearl Harbor, UFOs were a very common occurrence here all over the world, here in the States. We even had military people that were going on radio shows and in the 50s, even went on television, you know, telling the American public, anyone who sees a UFO and reports it to the nearest airbase or the authorities is a patriotic citizen doing a good thing. I mean, they were on television doing this. They were acknowledging that there were such things as UFOs, flying saucers. So the military knew. Everybody's known about this, and this activity has been going on for thousands of years. It just wasn't until the advent of photography that we started documenting this stuff. You know, in the early days, there were medieval paintings done. There were frescoes made by artists back in the 14th centuries that were depicting strange things in the skies, you know. Then you've got the petroglyphs, you know, from over up to 50,000 years ago, the ancient astronaut type stuff. So flying saucers and these objects have been around for eons. It's just that it wasn't until Pearl Harbor and the Battle of Los Angeles that we decided, or the military decided, you know, we better not let the people know that we are being visited by these flying saucers again, and this time we can't even bring them down. Okay, what was the public going to think? I mean, we were already petrified about the Japanese invasion. So here comes a new type of possible enemy or target. And, you know, as it goes with everything else, if they've been here for thousands of years, then they were definitely here in the 40s, 1938. They had the Foo Fighters, remember?
Yeah.
They had the Foo Fighters that were chasing even the Nazi airplanes. I mean, the Foo Fighters were around, and we've got turret camera footage of these things, you know? So it could have been a possibility that this huge object that came in was on a surveillance mission or a recon, you know, checking it out, or checking out the babes in Hollywood, for all we know. That, you know, we definitely have been visited and are still being visited, and that's, can't avoid it. It's just, they're there.
When did you become convinced that we are being visited?
Well, I had a major UFO sighting when I was back in 1966. It's in a rock and roll band, and we were coming out of Carlsbad, New Mexico about 3 in the morning. We had just played a prom dance, you know, our band.
Yeah.
We saw this thing come out of the sky, and it looked like a puff of smoke, big puff of smoke, bluish white. And then we thought maybe it was a parachute because we saw also this silver object that had red, green, blue, and yellow lights kind of veering off at an angle. Where we were at is we stopped at the bottom of this old prehistoric lake or riverbed, and where the highway loops down about a half a mile. And we stopped. There was a semi coming from the other way that pulled over because they saw this thing. It was a station wagon full of people. This thing flies right over us, and it was so big and so low. I jumped up and tried to hit the bottom of it. That's how big and low it was. So that was our first UFO encounter. We had some missing time after that. The next thing we know, we're about 10 miles away from the spot, and me and my bass player were driving, and we're giggling. You know, we're just kind of laughing. It's just kind of weird. The next, that night, we got back to Roswell, and we were groggy, all of us, all the band members, including our drummer's father who drove us there. We were groggy for 3 days, right? That next day, I think I slept for like about 12 hours. I mean, we were just totally out of it.
But you guys weren't smoking grass, were you?
No, not that morning. But see, we were not the only witnesses. There was that truck driver. I wish I could ever find out who he was. But for 3 days, we were in no man's land, groggy and just totally out of it. And finally, the event just vanished from our brains. I mean, we totally forgot about it. I know doggone well that was not a military aircraft. It was something else. And it was big, you know.
How big do you think it was?
We had other UFO sightings, me and the rock and roll band. And there were times we'd been drinking or smoking pot. So, but we know what we saw. It wasn't a hallucination, you know.
How big do you think this craft was?
I would say it was about 60 feet in diameter.
Mm-hmm.
It was big. It was big. It was pretty huge.
Did it make any noise?
Not at all. And here's what happened. As it flew right over us, and it made no noise whatsoever, there's a hill that it went over, and it dipped down. It just went swoop, and it dipped down. And I remember we put our hands over our ears because we thought this thing was going to explode, whatever it was. But nothing happened. And like I said, the next thing we know, we're 10 miles away. So we did have some missing time episode there. And here's the curious thing. When I started filming UFOs over Roswell and Midway in 94, and I was living in Roswell, I started having this recurring dream. And it was about me leaning up next to a large table, and I saw my bass drummer and my bass player and my drummer carting my drummer's dad on a gurney. And I said, oh, yeah, you better take him in that room. And it was like we were at a place, you know, somewhere, possibly inside a ship. Then the next thing I'm dreaming is I'm walking down this graded walkway, and to the right and the left there are these openings. They have like round windows. One of them looked like the Ace of Spades design. And in it there were creatures and things that were kind of weird. And I knew there were two somethings walking right behind me. And I'm going, yeah, I've seen that one before. Boy, you better keep that one in there. And, you know, I'm just doing that kind of thing. But I've had that same dream about three or four times back, you know, in the 90s when I started filming UFOs over Roswell. I don't know what it means. I don't know if that's what happened to us, you know. But that's my story about my abduction as far as I'm concerned.
Okay, so how old were you when this happened?
1966. Let me see, without giving up how old I am, man. Let me see. 1966 minus... I was 15 years old.
I'm just curious, what did you do in the rock band? What, singer, guitarist?
I was a lead guitarist, and I sang like Paul McCartney, brother.
I'm sure you did.
Had the Beatles haircut, had all the chicks, man. It was great. Rock and roll never dies, man.
So I guess you want to rock and roll all night and party every day.
That's basically it. We'd play all night till about 1 or 2 in the morning. We did some of the local nightclubs and stuff. We sleep most of the day, and we get up and rehearse. Then we go to the club and jam again. That was a nightly thing, you know.
Okay, so when did you make your first UFO film?
1994. It was called The Midway Sightings, which was on March 5th, 1994, I filmed 16 minutes of UFO activity over our farm, which is 9 miles south of Roswell, 2.5 miles south of the former Walker Air Force Base, which was where the 509th Squadron was located in the war. And filmed 16 minutes of UFO activity. It was broad daylight, and this object just hovered for a long time, and it zipped through the sky. In that 16 minutes, I captured close to about 15 different kinds of objects. Anything from triangle shapes, cigar-shaped. There was even something that looked like a Cracker Jack. Not Cracker Jack. You know, when you play jacks?
Mm-hmm.
You know, when girls play with the jacks?
Mm-hmm.
Those little jack thingies. There was something in the sky that was just like that, just hovering too, and it zipped away real fast. Strange things going on over Roswell, I guarantee you. You go out there with a camera, you're going to see stuff happening all the time. There's UFO activity going on there all the time. It's a hot spot.
Well, there seem to be several hot spots around the world, and one of them seems to be Phoenix, Arizona, and particularly the area around South Mountain in Phoenix, Arizona. I've seen a lot of stuff out there. Now, I want to get back, though, to this Battle of Los Angeles film that you're doing. Now, we have one that's called Battle of L.A. and then The Battle of Los Angeles, right? What is yours called?
The blockbuster film that costs like $70 or $100 million to make is called Battle, Los Angeles.
Okay.
And then this company that makes B-movies did a film that they showed on Sci-Fi Channel on the 15th of March, and it was called Battle of Los Angeles. My film is The Battle of Los Angeles.
I see. Okay.
Yeah. So, it could get confusing, but, you know, I've got to do it. That's the name of the film, The Battle of Los Angeles. That's the name that it's been known as, you know, ever since word got out on it. It is also known as the Great L.A. Raid, you know, to some people. That's another title.
The Great what? That.
The Great Los Angeles Air Raid, something of that nature.
Hmm.
But the Battle of Los Angeles is what it is, and, boy, you're going to see a battle.
Has it been difficult as you've gone about the business of trying to get this film together? Has it been difficult for you to come up with good material? And by good material, I'm talking about film of the battle, witnesses, pictures of the battle. Has it been covered up, or have you been able to access the information pretty readily?
No, there are tons of newspaper clippings, microfilm. What do you call it, microfilm?
Yeah.
And photographs that had been in the newspapers, and I'm tracking another scene taken by another news reporter of the event from a total different angle and perspective. See, the UFO that the LA Times photograph depicts with the searchlights, that famous LA Times photo, that was taken from a point on Culver City Boulevard or Washington Boulevard, one of those, right where the Baldwin Hills are. And that's where, you know, that photo, that famous photograph was taken. And on the other side of the Baldwin Hills, there was another news outfit, I guess, that photographed what was going on from the other side of the Baldwin Hills area. And I'm tracking that photograph down. It's in some microfilm thing, because if you look at some of the newspaper articles that are out there, they show this other photograph and the searchlights and everything else. But it's not. There's no hills obstructing it. You're actually seeing it from a street point of view. And I've recreated that scene sort of, but I'd like to get a real good picture of that.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to mix it. I'm going to mix the real footage and the real photographs with, my computerized animations and things too, because I want to. This film is going to definitely bring it, man. I'm going to tell you what this movie's sort of like. It's like the movie JFK. You know, Oliver Stone's film, which I think is one of my favorites because the way it was portrayed, it was filmed,
mm-hmm.
it took you there, you know. And I like that style of presenting, you know, what happened with the JFK assassination. This is that kind of movie. It's going to have that kind of essence to it. And it's going to take you there, you know. You're going to be seeing it. Here's another point. There was a policeman that was in Beverly Hills, and he reported to a news reporter, he said, these things, because he said there were other objects besides the shoes, he said, these other things were coming out of dark clouds. Now, here's the scenario. It was not a heavily cloudy night that evening. You know, there were sparse clouds. But the way he describes it, he says, these objects, there were objects coming out of dark clouds. And it kind of reminds me of the movie Independence Day, you know, where these objects are coming out of the clouds. They're coming out of these self-absorbing clouds,
mm-hmm.
you know, that are surrounding them, you know, before they emerge and are finally seen for what they are. But that was just a curious description that he did. So I'm creating a scene as he's telling it, portraying what he describes. And he described it in details. So it's just, this film is just going to have so much information and visual information that it's going to really open people's heads, man.
Now, are you doing this particular film sort of as a docudrama?
Yeah, basically. It's a docudrama. I'm trying to stay away from documentary, as you know, like my other documentary films that I've done.
Mm-hmm.
I'm doing this sort of like as a feature film. It's non-union, though. Because
mm-hmm.
I can't afford union talent at this point unless I get a decent budget. But there's definitely going to be actors portraying certain people. There's a lot. This film is just going to be so important for people to view, and it's going to come out with a bang. I guarantee you. It's really cool.
Okay, now when this battle was going on, you mentioned this in the first hour. That there was damage to people's houses and cars and office buildings from all the shrapnel raining down
mm-hmm.
on the city. Were there any casualties?
Reports are that there were 6 or 7 people that died. A couple of people died from heart attacks, elderly people. One of the policemen in Beverly Hills, because everybody was looking up and there were people driving, one of the policemen got run over and he was killed. Now, these are just the scattered reports. Now, you have to realize that if there would have been more casualties, it would have been a bigger story, because now we not only have something that we're firing at, but we had more casualties than were reported. And then that would be a bigger story. They just could not avoid telling the truth, you know, especially the newspaper reporters. So as far as we know, there were only 6 or 7 casualties. Some hit by shrapnel and, you know, the most part, heart attacks, guy got run over. But here's another curious thing, too. There are three memorandums, three memos that were given to that were military that described three objects that were brought down that night. One of them was the size of I guess we could consider it like a Volkswagen, and it was brought down, and it landed somewhere on some street in Long Beach. There was another one that was a pretty good sized one that crash landed at San Clemente, and the Navy picked that one up. The Army Air Corps picked up the one in Long Beach, and there was another one that that went down over in San Angeles Forest, of which the Army Air Corps also picked up. Now, guess where they took these objects to?
Wright Patterson?
Described in this memo, they were taken to what is now termed as Area 51.
Oh.
And this was back in 42.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they described they were being taken to the Groom Lake area where there's an installation. So that's, you know, that's how long that thing's been going on. And these are the reports, and we're going to portray it. I mean, this is all just some of the documented stuff that's out. We also have Franklin Delano Roosevelt that wrote a memorandum to all the Joint Chiefs of Staff and everyone else, and he's saying, look, the Russians must not find out the wondrous technology that we've just acquired. Okay, he said they must not know about what we just acquired from that event that went down in February. So there's a lot of information that's going to be surfacing off this film, and like I said, I'm going to portray everything as realistic and as true to the story as I can, and to the best of my ability, just bring you a real good movie to watch that delivers it, you know?
Well, I'm very curious about these memos now, because I've not heard of this before. So you're saying there are three military memos that talk about these.
What started it all, basically?
I'm sorry.
There was a second memorandum. I forget who wrote it. It was one of the top dogs, man, and he's the one that's describing how, you know, it was reported that these are not conventional aircraft that came down. We feel that they are interplanetary. That's the way the words are. I'll get you copies of that and send them to you. But they described it, you know, and described the Army Air Corps picked one up in San Angeles Forest, one went down in Long Beach, and then the one over in San Clemente Island that the Navy picked up. So it's documented. Now, we always have those skeptics and the debunkers that come out and say, oh, that's all fake stuff, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just a problem with a lot of the stuff that we got Freedom of Information Act. A lot of the stuff has been doctored or made up by those people that want to keep it, you know, as a conspiracy, keep it covered up. But that's all we have to deal with, and I'm just portraying it, you know. I'm just making a film about the event that surfaced, information that came out afterward. And you know, this is going on not only since 1942, but that Battle of Los Angeles carried through all through the 50s, the 60s, 70s, even to the present time, because of what happened that day, that morning, the repercussions of the official denial and how the military tried to just push it into the rug is what's created this whole mess that we're in, with the ridicule and with the death threats and all that kind of stuff that emerged out of this later on. And this is portrayed in the film. You know, there's a lot more that's to this story than meets the eye. And that's why I'm saying I'm chomping at the bit, man. If I could just get one or two angels to come in there, I'd hear you, man. I'd be jamming, man.
We have to step away for a break. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show and to my guest this evening, Jose Escamilla. Jose, Got a couple of questions that come to mind here based on what you just told us about. You told us about these memos that talk about that three objects were brought down and that they were recovered. Army Air Corps recovered two of them. The U.S. Navy recovered one of them. And these objects were sent to what today we call Area 51.
Yes.
Are there any witnesses, any civilian witnesses that have ever stepped forward and said, I saw that craft that crashed?
There are, well, the most, Scotty Lloyd was the most outspoken one, you know, but he passed away last November. There are four left. One was at one of the firing installations that, you know, where the cannons were shooting from, and he was viewing this thing with the binoculars. And he definitely says it was not a weather balloon. So, there are only four people left. This is why I'm kind of in a rush to get this thing funded so I can, you know.
Well, what I'm asking about, though, is specifically, were there any witnesses that saw these objects that crashed, the ones that were brought down?
I'm pretty sure. That, I mean, you know, the Army Air Corps, I mean, these were the guys that go out and retrieve things, you know, but I'm sure they, if they're not alive anymore, they took it with them to their graves. You know what I'm saying? So,
well, some of the younger guys that were present, in the recovery would still be alive, most likely.
Yeah, but how do we find their names? You know?
Well, maybe they're listening to the show tonight. And
if they are, contact me.
Yeah.
Jeez.
Yeah, and
so that would be interesting to find out exactly how the recovery went. Were there any bodies? What routes did you take? How did you hide it from the general public?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that would be a heck of just one crash would be a heck of a story. So all we have is a memorandum. So, you know.
Now, if they wanted to get in touch with you, they could go to your website, and you have contact information on your website, do you not?
Yes, and you can give out my direct email. It's Jose, J-O-S-E, and there's four letters, T as in Tom, B as in Bob, L as in Larry, N as in Nancy, .com. That's Jose at TBLN.com.
Very good. So if there are any surviving members of the rescue squads that went out there and picked up these, or recovery squads that went out and picked up these objects from the Battle of Los Angeles, get in touch with Jose Escamilla and tell him your story, and let's get this out there to the public. Jose, I asked you before if you thought there was any linkage between the Battle of Los Angeles and these giant spacecraft that are out there. Let's assume for a minute that there is not. Let's assume that there is no linkage between the two.
Right.
What do you suspect these giant spacecraft are all about? What do you suspect they're doing out there?
Well, for one thing, I know that they're orbiting Earth, posing as stars, and they're far enough away, but we can't see them with the naked eye and even with a regular telescope. You know, they still appear like stars. However, if they're, like I said, if they're ours, fine, that's great. We have some major starships out there that are inhabited by humans and some army personnel or Air Force, whatever, and are protecting us or keeping an eye out on Earth. But if they're not ours, then it's very, you know, you have to question, man, what or who is there and what are they doing? We have no idea, but they're there. That's the whole thing about it, is that they are there.
Well, they apparently have been there for quite some time. We don't know how long, but obviously they were there before John Leonard Walson saw them.
Probably, yeah.
And, well, you know, they didn't just show up the day he started looking at them. That's what I'm saying. The day he started seeing them through his telescope was not their first day in position.
No, that was in the year 1998 that he started this.
Okay. So they've been there for a while, and there is, you know, among the UFO community, there is a division of opinion about extraterrestrials. Some people say that extraterrestrials are benevolent. They don't want to hurt us. And the proof of that is that at any moment they could have turned this planet into a wisp of smoke, and they haven't done it.
Right.
There are others who say they think that extraterrestrials are hostile to us, and they base that on the many abduction stories.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I do want to say that just because we have not been attacked...
Aliens as enemies.
Well, I want to say that just because we have not been attacked by them, so far as we know, does not mean they're benevolent. It may just mean they're indifferent, that they're minding their business and they expect us to do the same. It could be that.
Well, even Carl Sagan, in one of his books, he mentioned, he says, you know, the Syrians, man, you know, they might have been of extraterrestrial origin and may have come here and created Christianity, for all we know. I mean, even Carl Sagan was talking about, you know, the possibilities that we are of extraterrestrial origin ourselves. I mean, it's a big controversy. You know, people can talk about it, but we just don't know, do we? All we know is that these things are there, and I'm doing to the best of my ability to present the evidence of their being there.
Mm-hmm.
What they are, who controls them, who's driving the ship, I have no idea.
I wish I could drive one. There. I wish I could drive one.
Me too. I'd head right to the moon and take my video cameras and capture the best color footage of the moon ever.
Well, you know, if you had one of these things, you could probably land on the moon, and you'd have a base of operations from which to work, and you could get out and stroll around and take video.
Yeah, absolutely. That would be the thing to do.
Now, the FDR memo that you mentioned, and for those who don't know FDR, because our audience is all the way around the world, and perhaps there are some who don't know what that is, FDR is how we refer to, very often, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who was president of the United States, I believe, for 12 years. And after him is when they passed the amendment saying that you, president can only have two terms. But he was elected three times, and had he lived, he would have been elected a fourth term.
Yeah.
So this memo from FDR, who is the memo to?
To the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
Okay.
And others, you know, other military. It was a top secret memorandum, you know, sent out through the system. Now, I don't have that on the computer that I'm on right now. It's on my editing computer, which is busy rendering right now, so I can't even tap it. Otherwise, I'd send it to you right now. But I'll get that to you later.
Okay. Now, he sends this memo, and it tells them precisely what?
Basically saying that this new wondrous, how did he put it, man? He says this new wondrous technology that we have allocated from those objects that were brought down, or something to that effect, Kevin. Don't quote me on this at this point. I'd have to read the full document. But he's describing to the effect of, we must not let the Russians know that we have this wondrous new technology, devices or what have you. So this is just strictly kept secret, and we will never disclose this to anybody. You know, he was just telling everybody, keep your mouth shut. Don't tell anybody that we just absconded some awesome technology.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, this could have included weaponry, too, for all we know, these craft at that time. Thank God they didn't fire at us. Can you imagine?
Well, yeah, I think it's fortunate that they didn't, you know, and this would be another bit of evidence for those who say, well, you know, they don't plan us any harm. I think obviously when you're shooting 12-pound anti-aircraft shells at someone, if they have the ability to shoot back, you expect they would.
Yeah.
And
they didn't,
and you know, I think it sort of indicates they don't have hostile intentions. But we also have to consider the fact that there's not just one group of these extraterrestrials. How many nations are there on Earth?
I know.
Okay. Now, if you were sitting on another planet and you were saying, well, what are the Earthlings like? Well, it depends on where you go as to what the Earthlings are like. They're red, yellow, black, white, brown, peaceful, not peaceful, very serene, very fanatic. I mean, you name it, there's some Earthlings that fit the category. And I would suspect that the same thing is probably true of extraterrestrial civilizations, that they are not all that different in that respect. There are probably some that very, very peaceful, and others that, you know, they got a chip on their shoulder and they're ticked off when they get here. I think all of that's possible.
Absolutely. You know, Clifford Stone mentioned at the disclosure conference that when he finally got out of the army, or the military, that at that time, and this was like in the 60s, I believe, 60s, 70s, when he finally retired, he said at that time they had logged 58 species of extraterrestrials that are among us. 58 species, and this was like, you know, the 70s when he retired. So another thing that Cliff mentioned, which is curious, is he says this in my movie UFO, The Greatest Story Ever Denied, Part 1. He said that we perceive these extraterrestrials as, you know, inanimate objects. Like, you know, he pointed out to her, like that cushion there that's on that chair. You know, we don't look at them as humanoid human beings. He says there have been many times, because he was in the retrieval business with the Air Force, going out to retrieve wreckage. Says when they'd go out, they'd find that the extraterrestrials had already been there and taken the occupants and whatever they wanted to take that they didn't want us to have access to. So he says when just like when we have an airplane crash or a chopper or something, we send out a distress signal and a rescue crew comes out and you know, takes care of us. He says, well, the aliens do the same thing. When they have a distress signal, their crews come out and clean it up and take the wounded or what have you, and they take off. He says that they are just like us. They have needs. They have culture. They have love. They have hate. They have the same kind of qualities that we do. So if we have 58 species that were among us at that time, like you said, man, there's different varieties of human beings, just like I'm pretty sure extraterrestrials are different varieties too.
Well, in this series of video clips from John Leonard Walson, we see a whole bunch of different type of craft. And I mean, and you said that there's over 50 of them out there that you know about. And they all look different. You know, we're looking, like I said, some of these look like machinery, like a spacecraft. Some of them look almost wispy. Maybe the 58 species each have one of these motherships in orbit out there. We'll be back right after this. And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. We're on Final Approach, ladies and gentlemen. Make sure your seat is in the upright position and make sure your tray is stored away, your seat belt is fastened, because we will be coming in for a landing here pretty soon. My guest is Jose Escamilla. Jose, as we went to break, I was making the suggestion that you've said that there are at least 50 of these spaceships out there that you know about. And I was simply saying, well, if Clifford Stone says there are 58 species that have been cataloged, perhaps each one of these species has one of these spaceships they're from. What do you think about that?
What I do have, I have about 178, maybe 200 clips that Walson sent me. And out of those, I counted about 50 or 52 objects that were totally different from each other. Now, whether or not those are sending aliens to be among us, I have, you know, we don't have any evidence of that. But I know for doggone sure that there were about 50 different objects that Walson filmed over the course of the last 10 years.
Do you think that your film, The Battle of Los Angeles, do you think that it has an opportunity to make a real impact for the true story that we've been talking about here tonight?
Yes, I do. I scripted it, and it delivers the goods all the way around. Whoever watches this film, and maybe it'll go straight to DVD. I don't know. I'm trying to get a theatrical deal going. Maybe it'll go straight to DVD or streaming video or something. But it delivers the goods, you know. And it's all due to the great documentation that was done by the reporters of that era.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they were after the big story. The war, you know, they were documenting everything detail by detail. They were not leaving any stone unturned. They were always looking for the big story. And this was a huge event that happened. 3.5 hours of us shooting at I don't want to call it an invader, but a visitor that hovered over Culver City and just traveled along the coast casually, flew right over downtown L.A. on the back, coming back to Culver City, and we fired at it, unprovoked. So that was a major story, and the news reporters made it a point to gather all as much information as they could. And
well, you know, here's an interesting anomaly.
No longer in the newspapers.
Here's a very interesting anomaly in this current world in which we live. The number one search term, the number one thing searched for on the internet is pornography. The number two thing, and it runs a close second,
UFOs.
So you would think that with that being worldwide, the number two thing that people are interested in, you would think that that would equate to plenty of money for filmmakers and plenty of money for people who are writing books that document what's really going on with UFOs. But the truth is, it's extremely difficult for anyone dealing with the subject of UFOs to make a living. Some people do, but it's extremely difficult. Why do you think that is?
Well, as far as I'm concerned anyway, it's been very difficult for me to make my films and research. When I was researching the Rods phenomenon, I did my best. I mean, I took it to the National Museum of Natural History, you know, tried to get funding so that we could do more research, get better documenting equipment. I think it is a phenomenon that exists in order to squelch the story. The only things that you see on History Channel, Sci-Fi, Discovery, and all these other channels of National Geographic, the only thing you see there about UFOs is stuff that they have the usual suspects. They have the eyewitnesses, the footage, and then they have the debunkers. It's the same kind of scenario all the time. You know, UFO Hunters to me was one of the better ones, but even it had its local skeptic, you know. Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know, I think it could have been this. That's been, and it's been difficult for me because I don't have any idiots in there that are going to debunk anything. I mean, they have their own shows already. You know, I'm presenting the evidence as it stands. You know, and then they try to pick it apart afterwards. But I'm not going to give these bozos any airtime on my films. And it's been very difficult. History Channel, check this out. I had a sales agent that was trying to sell Moon Rising to the History Channel, and they said, well, this is going to have to be re-edited. So he said, well, how much are we going to have to take out? And they said, practically everything. So in other words, they were telling me the only thing that we'll pay for is the opening credits and the end credits. The rest in between is just too controversial. You know, a lot of these networks, they're in bed with NASA and with the Department of Defense and all that. They're showing you what you want, they want you to see, but they don't want you to see certain things. Hopefully, I'll be able to get the Battle of Los Angeles on the air somewhere. We'll have to see.
Well, some of the foreign markets, you know, a number of other countries are have much more freedom than we have here in the United States, particularly when it comes to this subject. And some of the foreign governments.
An Italian television network that wanted to license Moon Rising, and they wanted, you know, a lot of the European rights and everything else, and we had structured some kind of a deal, but then all of a sudden they changed their minds. So things like that happen in this business, you know. It's just really tough. Mm-hmm. But I do have an old friend of mine that before I got into the UFO stuff, I was doing regular films and cartoons and things. And he's resurfaced, and he's strong, man. He's got some heavy-duty connections, and he and I are putting together some deals, and there may be a chance he might finally get me funded properly and distribute it so I don't have to do everything.
Uh-huh.
You know, get these discs down and marketed and put up correctly so I don't have to deal with every aspect of making these movies and self-distributing them. But it's been tough, but you just got to keep on plugging away. You know, you just can't give up.
Well, you are right about that. You are.
Yeah.
But it is true that next to sex, the most searched for stuff on the Internet has to do with UFOs. And most of the people who are trying to get that information out there, writers, filmmakers, etc., radio shows, have an extremely difficult time getting just the bare minimum money to be able to do it. And it's a very interesting phenomenon. I personally have not figured that out yet. Jose, thank you for being with us this evening, and I want you to stay on the phone with me for just a moment here as I bring the Starship in for a landing. Ladies and gentlemen, if you click Jose's picture on my website, it will take you to his website. Okay, it is linked. And so you want to go over there and take a look at what is available. There is some phenomenal, phenomenal information available at the TBLN.com website. Like I say, click his picture and it will take you there. Very, very quickly, let me remind you, if you have not yet subscribed to the K-Files, be sure you do. That's free. If you're not a member, you can't watch the show, and you can't get in the forums, and you can't get to the archives, and it's not free. But it's pretty darn close. It's only 23 cents a day. $6.95 a month. So why not join us in the members area today, okay? You can do that. It's real simple. It's a little bit less expensive if you go quarterly, and even less expensive if you go annually. So go ahead and jump in. You will like what's in the water. Again, let me remind you, this is all about you. If you ever were my sunshine, you still are my sunshine, and I hope you'll be back here tomorrow for another edition of the Kevin Smith Show. My friends call me Steel Eye, my enemies do too, and you can call me whatever you want to call me. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.